Right now, I am joined by Clementine Ford. Clementine has just published her new book, I Don't, The Case Against Marriage, and will be appearing at the Margaret River Readers and Writers Festival next month to talk about it. It is a manifesto. It is a very clear-cut argument against the institution of marriage, presented as an inarguable truth that continues to be ignored. She joins us now to talk about I Don't. Welcome, Clementine.
Hi, Beck. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So, like, I have been running around for years telling people that marriage is a rot, and I had to stop because I quite like a wedding and I wasn't getting invited anymore. Do you think that's kind of the crux of your argument, is that we will willingly put aside these detrimental impacts of marriage in order to kind of celebrate this public spectacle of love and romance?
I think that's part of it. And I should be clear for your listeners as well, because people get very, funnily enough, very defensive about marriage. I make a distinction even in the book between when I'm talking about marriage, and yes, de facto partnership is kind of like included under the banner of the aspiration sense of that. But this is not a critique of love. It's not a critique of falling in love. It's not a critique of like building a life with someone. I see those two things as distinct from the government having any kind of say or control over your relationship or codifying it or providing you with, you know, quantifiable benefits. What is it that, okay, so we know the legal benefits of marriage and why people are drawn into it, but I don't think that that's why people are signing the document. Because when, you know, oftentimes people will say, well, we got married because we wanted the party. And I say, well, you could have just had a party.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about the marriage? What is it about saying to people, well, we're married, that actually is not about some kind of, you know, performance of your relationship to other people, you know, like, yes, we are married, we're committed to each other, because we know, of course, that the divorce rate is also high and marriage is not forever, and nor should marriage be treated as being something that has to be forever. So what is this kind of like, you know, I quote in the book, I quote Pride and Prejudice, Lydia Bennett saying, no, Jane, you must go lower, for I am a married woman. There's something for women especially that still speaks to us being elevated in the eyes of society and elevated even in the eyes of ourselves, because we've been indoctrinated with decades worth of, you know, romantic fiction, certainly in the 20th century, decades worth of romantic comedies, narratives that tell us that the most important thing that women especially can find is someone, preferably a man, to love them and stand before the world and say, yes, I choose you.
Oh, it's about being chosen, isn't it? It's about being
chosen,
claimed as worthy by this one particular person.
Well, which is why a lot of women feel so, I guess, bereft is the wrong word, but so ashamed, I think is the right word, of divorce. And it's not because divorce is punitive and punishing and financially destructive. It's not because, you know, this is maybe something that your listeners should think about practically as well, but men's income is damaged by about 5% after divorce. Women's income is damaged by over 25%. And that is, and much takes much longer for women to recover their finances as well after divorce. So we're punished socially for not being married. We're punished by being mocked as, you know, you'll grow old, you'll be an old cat lady, you'll be a spinster, all of these tropes that still exist today in our supposedly post-feminist world. But we're also punished for ending marriages that, once you're sort of, you know, into the gingerbread house, you realize it's a big trap and you're just being waited to be herded into the oven. Where women, yes, again, we know that women's emotional load, women's mental labor, women's unpaid domestic labor increases drastically the moment they cohabit. And that's not even, that's before marriage, that's just cohabitation with a partner. So the thing of being chosen, I think, is really important. So when women get divorced, yes, they're being punished in all those other ways, but there's some sense of having failed. You know, women will talk about, I failed at it. And what I think they mean, and what we've been instructed to believe about ourselves as women, is that if we can't keep the man once he's chosen us, even if we choose to leave him, that that somehow everyone else will see us for who we really are. And I'd love to direct your listeners to the works of Bell Hooks, who in her book, Unconditional Love. Oh God, I'm just blanking on that. It's terrible. I'm approaching perimenopause, so I'm having these moments of brain fog. But just Bell Hooks, her book Communion. She talks about how women are born into a world that, you know, we know that the world is inherently sexist and misogynistic. It's been built on sexist and misogynistic values. Even if anyone listening now doesn't believe that it is currently, you have to at least admit that for thousands of years it was. And therefore, women have this sense of being inherently unlovable from birth based on the messages that we receive from society. And because we are humans and humans crave connection and love and intimacy, and that is a natural, beautiful thing to want, is love and intimacy in your life. But so many women don't actually feel seen by their partners. They don't feel respected by their partners. So we kind of like, the part of this being chosen is this idea that on our own, on our base sort of like level, we're nothing. We have to kind of graduate into the experience of humanness. And we do that by virtue of having someone, again, preferably a man, look at us and say, you'll do. Mm-hmm. Yes. I choose you. I now have the power to anoint you with humanity by choosing you to be my wife. And one of the things that I'm trying to do with the book is really not just get people to see, and women especially, to see what a trap marriage is, and a trap in the sense of like, if we hold this to be a thing deeply aspirational in our heart, that my life will not really have mattered if I didn't find that great love story, that actually deprives us of pursuing ourselves. It deprives us of pursuing the things that we care about and creating a fulfilling life on our own terms with ourselves at the center of it. Because when you think about it as well, this idea of the great love story that we've kind of been force-fed and what we crave, even when, you know, people will stand there and say, I'm marrying my best friend. It's like, are you really? Because your best friend's sitting in the front row, the one who actually knows you and listens to you and talks to you and, like, respects you, is not the one that you're standing up at the altar with. But when you think back through history, and especially the history of women who had very little choice often when it came to marriage, where were the great love stories? Like, it's actually not the common theme that great love exists for everybody. Great love exists for barely anybody. And what we need to then divest ourselves from is this idea that unless we have that, we've somehow missed out on an integral part of living, because living is all around us at all points, you know. And women, we have love in our lives with our friends, with our family, with our children, which you obviously don't need to be married to have. We have love for ourselves. There are so many different capacities and ways in which we can find what it is we think we're chasing in terms of meaning by getting married, that firstly, you know, give us a really well-rounded perspective of living, and that also don't make our life something that is done in service of others.
I guess having read the book and having like nodded so hard so many times, I was like, but we know this already. Like, this is not new information. So what is it that keeps us stuck in this loop? Why do we continue to go to marriage as the be all and end all?
Because it's a very compelling magical spell that's being worked, that if you do this, you will get this. And we love magic. You know, we want to believe that it'll happen for us. Everyone believes they'll be the exception. And some of them will be right, but it'll be a tiny percentage of people who believe that. Most people will find out that actually the great love that they thought they were getting into, and I'm talking even if people have like quite satisfying marriages, you know, I'm not saying that like every marriage is terrible and then there's a handful of great ones. Obviously there's a pretty, you know, the bell curve indicates that probably there's a high proportion of people who are like, yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. All right.
But I speak to a lot of people as well who are in that, yeah, we're pretty happy together kind of category, who 10, 15 years after getting married say to me, but I don't really know why we got married. Like, it's not, the marriage itself has nothing to do with the relationship. So even on that basis, when you think about that, people say, well, we wanted to stand up in front of our friends and family. Okay, again, just have a party. You don't need to sign a document. You don't need to hand over your information to a government that then uses marital rates to justify, for example, conservative family value policies. And that's one of the arguments that I make, is that if you're getting married, you're essentially giving statistical data to governments to say, well, this is a nation of families, and so therefore we need to do this conservative policy at the expense of this, you know, communal policy, because we're catering to the families. By siloing off people into small groups and putting someone, usually a woman, in charge of that small group to make sure that that small group is taken care of, not only do you ensure that the government doesn't have to spend as much money as they otherwise would taking care of citizens, because women are doing all that work for free, and also not being supported when they actually produce humans into the world, but also you create in people's minds, I think, this sense of individualism. I have to protect my family. Mm-hmm. And so it works in service of, you know, maintaining and propping up elite power systems, because if people are catering to the idea that that their true priority is their family, and of course, look, I get it. I've got a child. He is my number one priority in the world, of course. But I think that I have a much broader kind of understanding of community being important, because I'm not attached to this idea that my family is the thing that I will protect. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And just to go back to something that you said at the beginning as well, having worked in healthcare for a long time, having seen a lot of people come to the end of their lives, marriage is no guarantee that you will not end up dying alone.
Oh, absolutely. You know, people say that, men love especially to say that to women, good luck dying alone. It's like the number of women who are abandoned by husbands when they experience illness.
And children.
And children, but illness as well, like, is terrifyingly high. You know, a friend of mine who has had breast cancer says, oh my God, you need to see the support groups for women with breast cancer, because there are really shockingly high numbers of them whose husbands either leave them because I didn't sign up for this, or who leave them after double mastectomies because he's lost his boobs. Like, it's disgraceful. And again, I'm not saying that that's every man who'll do that. That's clearly like a particular kind of, you know, parasitic man. But the risk there is not something, I mean, no one can be guaranteed of anything. Your partner could die and you could still end up alone. They could cheat on you. You could get to 50, both of you, and say, well, we're not really happy anymore. Let's end this marriage. The other thing as well that I would ask your listeners to think about, particularly your female listeners, is on the flip side of that, it's actually not uncommon for men who have been through divorce, for example, if they're going through palliative care, to have their ex-wives come and take care of them.
Yes, I have seen this as well.
Yeah, so this is, something I would say about that is that obviously that's, you know, again, an indicator of who really gains from marriage, because it's not really women. Women benefit in very like coordinated ways from marriage in a society that refuses to allow women to take charge of their own lives, you know, that has constructed itself to the degree where, you know, even with the cost of living crisis, say, people say, well, you know, it's just, I can't afford to live alone. It's like, well, that's, you should not be getting married or moving in with someone because it's impossible to live by yourself. Why not live with a friend? Why not buy a house with a friend? Oh, well, that's too risky. And it's not risky to buy a house with someone that essentially the core of your relationship is that you like to sleep with each other. Like, that is not strong enough. And funnily enough, like, marriage proponents in, you know, the late 19th century, late 18th and into the 19th century, who were kind of coming up against this new wave of young people who were like, you know what, we don't want to get married for economics anymore. We want to get married for love. Because love marriage, which is called companionate marriage, is actually quite historically recent. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously people have fallen in love throughout history, but they didn't get married to the people that they loved. And when this was happening, the same sort of classic narrative of the old looking at the young going, you do not know life and you don't know what you're talking about, responded to this sort of influx of companionate marriage with, what are you doing? You're crazy. Marriage is too important to build it on something as flimsy and insubstantial as love. And this was the attitude and it was the understanding. And I think that that's very wise, that if you are going to get married, if you insist on it, you know, it's beautiful, the idea that you'll fall in love, but don't trap yourself into a situation where you either legally, financially, or even just emotionally feel like it's difficult to leave it, as is the case with marriage. But so if you're building a life with someone and you want to economically secure your future together, there's nothing to say that we can't develop a new tradition in which that is done between friends who sign contracts, who actually, ironically enough, go into that partnership with more legal protections because of how they will do it together, as opposed to, well, it's unromantic to sign a contract. Let's not go to a lawyer. Oh, my God, a prenup? Do you think I'm going to steal all your money? Like, you would never take a job, accept a job or a contract for a job, where if you asked what the pay was, you were told that you were just being money hungry. And if you asked what the contract renewal sort of process was, they just said, well, if you're asking about renewing contracts, that means you might be asking about leaving, and that doesn't sound like you're very committed to the job. Just sign on the line here and everything else will work itself out. Like, you wouldn't take a job on that basis. So why do people get married without really seriously considering? And another thing as well, and I know we're sort of coming to the end of our time, but another thing as well is people have children with someone who fundamentally ends up shocking them with how they view the raising of that child. Like, I'm in a lot of mums groups, and I see women saying things like, oh, I'm really concerned because my husband, you know, he doesn't want our son to wear nail polish. He doesn't want our son. He thinks all of that stuff is blah, blah. And I'm like, did you not know this before you decided to have a child with this person? How can you not know that? How can you not? And also, how can you be in a relationship with someone whose values are clearly fundamentally different from your own? Which goes back to the idea of being chosen. Well, he's here and he wants me. So therefore, I'm lucky.
And now I have to kind of manipulate my way around these beliefs of his in order to raise our children in a way that I'm happy with.
A single woman like me, and a single mother especially like me, often comes up against the mockery of a society that is terrified of more women like me being created, because women do all of that unpaid work supporting men's progress throughout the world. And, you know, if I'm told, oh, you're going to be alone, you're a miserable old cat lady, blah, 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 I'm like, honestly, there's nothing that a man could say to me that would really hurt my feelings. But also, do you know what is so blissful about my life is that I don't have to compromise with a guy who kicks his shoes off in the middle of my floor and who waits for me to make him dinner. I don't have to compromise myself. I don't have to, you know, just take deep breaths because I'm having to, like, deal with someone's annoying idiosyncrasies. I don't have to contort myself to do any of that kind of work. And I don't have to look at the person that I married and go, what the fuck have I done with my life? So I guess one of the things that I would like the book to function as is also a permission slip for women to leave. You don't have to stay, because what you actually signed up into is a myth. It's a farce, and it's designed to make you want it so that it can trap you in it. So if you're looking for a sign, women listening, if you're looking for a sign to leave, let this be your sign.
Clementine, thank you so much.
Thank you, Beck. It was great to talk to you.
I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Margaret River too.
Yes, Margaret River on the 16th and 17th of May.
There's a few tickets left for my session, I think, but I think it's almost sold out. So get along.
That was Clementine Ford talking about her new book, I Don't.